You're listening to Face Off, Episode 8, recorded March 1st, 2009. Welcome to Face Off Show, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we like to talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes at faceoffshow.com or follow us via Twitter at twitter.com/faceoffshow.
All right. Once again, we're going to jump in there right up to the web apps. And yeah. The first one we got is domainr, domainr.
I love the web 2.0 trend of just misspelling things, and somehow that is clever and exciting.
Yeah. Well, if you like it, this thing, domainr, will actually help you find URLs that are similar to that.
Okay. So, So yeah, I mean, what is domainr, Mark, and how would I use this?
Well, if you're looking for a name for your app, you know, if you're ever looking around, it's hard to find apps that aren't web domains that are already taken.
Yeah,
like domain squatters.
Man, yeah, it's tough anymore. It seems
that's how a lot of these did. You know, a lot of these URLs came about. Like, just let's think of a random word and.
Exactly. Like, oh, I wanna make this really cool thing that is, you know, about flicking, what would you call it? Like a flip cartoon or something, and I want to call it Flickr. Oh, Flickr is taken. So, you know, and even then, well, actually, that's a bad example because even the misspelling of Flickr is taken.
Yeah. But what this does is you put in a domain keyword or something that you think you want to do, and it'll actually find. The ending of a, what do you call that? The suffix?
Oh.
Of a URL, the dot whatever, dot com, dot yeah. net, dot TV, dot MP, dot US, dot, you know, all those, yeah. Like delicious, you know.
What is that one?
DEL dot ICIO dot US. So they use a subdomain.
Dot US.
Dot US.
Yeah. Okay. So it's like top level domain.
So I'm just going to type in face off right now, and here's what I get. F.ac
oh.
is the domain, and then slash EOFF.
Okay. Okay, good.
That's kind of ridiculous, I think.
Yeah.
But as you can see, I mean, that includes a folder, a directory. So you, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, well, it is and it isn't. I mean, I don't want to send people to a directory of my domain. I don't,
no,
you know,
true.
I don't want to be like, hey, check out f.ac/eoffshow. I mean, because you can't just tell them to go to Face Off Show because you have to give them sort of the domain,
mm-hmm.
right?
Here's a like example. You could get blo.gs blogs.
Oh, that would be that's clever. Great, that's good,
and that's a short URL. I mean, that would be worth something. And it's probably already taken by now, but.
Yeah, it puts a little green box next to ones that are available currently.
Is that what it does? Because that was going to be my next question is, does it tell you which ones are taken?
Yeah, so I'm going to do Jade Robbins. Let's see what we got for Jade Robbins. So, yeah, it came up with, obviously, jaderobbins.com. It came up with .net and .org, and .net and .org are available.
So green is taken?
Jade Rob. No, it's available.
Oh, okay. So no, Jade, that can't be right because linux.com is green. There's got a green box by it.
It was for sale.
Oh.
I don't know.
Is it for sale?
But, okay, so, I mean, here.
Well, if you click on it, it'll tell you if it's taken.
jaderob.in/s
yeah,
is available.
That's not very good.
That's silly, but it's cool. Like, but, I could get jade.ro. That seems to make sense, right?
Yeah.
Or ja.de.
Here's one. There's a kind of a cool one, outside.in.
Oh, man, that is really clever.
So there's some good ones.
Okay, that's good. So this just kind of helps you find clever URLs or clever domains if what you want is already taken. And it's getting tough. I mean, as a sort of, you know, person making websites, you want kind of a .com or a .net, maybe .us.
Yeah, like delicious. I have a hard time getting that one.
I can never remember it. Yeah. Delicious.com works.
Does it?
So
now?
I just go to delicious.com yeah. because I can never remember Dell, and I have to like count it off on my fingers, like DLICO. You know, Scriptaculous was like that too for the longest time, and I could never ever remember it. It just drove me nuts.
But like ping.fm would be a nice one, but although that's a little bit different. But I like their tagline. They've got al.ph for alpha. For like beta, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So they're cool. Yeah, it's al.ph/a. There's a little slash a in there you can't see.
Oh yeah, I see.
But it's just a way, maybe if you're having trouble finding stuff, you can go look at various domain mix ups and stuff. Like a good one is logarith.hm for logarithm, you know. That's great.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's getting increasingly harder to find domains.
Yeah, because you want a .com or a .net, you know, like I said, maybe even a .us. And so now their solution is to say, well, we're adding all kinds of new fun domains like .mobi and .me or .name, which are cool, but it just doesn't seem to, they don't have that recognition yet, especially since they've just kind of started pumping them out towards the end, because it's like, well, all these .coms are taken, so we're going to add a whole bunch more, but that it still doesn't have the clout that .com or .net has.
Mm-hmm. Even .com.
I mean, that's obviously why we went faceoffshow.com instead of faceoff.com, because, I mean, there's no way that Faceoff is taken, or I mean, is available.
That's available, yeah.
So, or maybe, but, I mean, I'm satisfied with our URL. It fits, at least. I was glad that we found one that fits that was .com. I mean, faceoff.com would have been really nice, but...
If there was a .of domain, maybe there'd be something, but...
Yeah, that might be clever. I would still get, like, faceoffshow.com and then say, or you can just go to face.off or something. If there was a .off, that would be cool.
Like face, yeah. Or .ff, face.o, and then ff or something.
I don't know, but see, that's the tough part, is it needs to be something you can say, like... you know, outside dot in. Yeah, that sounds good.
That's a good one.
You know, if we could say face dot off, just go to face dot off.
Mm-hmm. And that chimp one was good too. Dot mp.
Yeah.
Here's that good one, burrito, burri, and then dot to.
But see, that's hard to say. You can't say like
dot to or two.
Yeah, burrito. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you need. It's only super clever if you can just say it in a sentence really easily.
Like outside in.
Yeah, like I don't want to be like, you know, I want to be like, go to j.robbins. I don't want to go like, go to jaderob.in/s.
Yeah, that loses, that defeats the whole
purpose. It's only clever looking at it, not audibly. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, like delicious is clever audibly, but not easy enough. Too difficult.
Well, it's a good tool to use if you're looking for something.
That's okay. All right, we'll so next I next thing we're going to talk about is a little thing I found, Mark, I wanted to show you, called Pingvine.
Okay.
You can get to it at pingvine.com.
Easy domain.
Easy domain. This is a really simple application. It's nothing too fancy. What it does is you give it an RSS feed. You give it a frequency in which you want it to update. And then you can select either Twitter, ping.fm, or identica.ca.
Okay.
And what it does is it checks that RSS feed, and if there's something new, it, you know, it just posts it on Twitter, it posts it on ping.fm, or it posts it on Identica for you. So, I mean, a lot of us, like, whenever I write a new blog post, this has some caveats, too. I mean, I saw the look on your face, and I know I thought the same things as you did. You know, whenever I make a new blog post, I just put it up anyways. I go, you know, to ping.fm, and I say, hey, I wrote a new blog post, check it out, with a tiny URL. Mm-hmm. This does it for you, but then again, you sort of lose that genuine attitude.
Yeah,
that
I'd rather say, hey guys, I like this article I just wrote, go to here or something.
Yeah, I mean, they can tell that it's fake. Mm-hmm. Maybe if you were like a, I don't know, it's one of those things we talk about. It's if you were a corporate account, maybe if you had you're making a lot of blog posts a day.
So,
like CNN could use this, right? Because, I mean, the CNN breaking news feed is just, you know, it's just going to be spitting out breaking news. I don't want genuine human emotions in with my CNN breaking news. I just want breaking news in my Twitter feed. Okay. It would be great for this.
Yeah. I notice here, I don't see a sign up, but you just put in your username and password and hit feed URL. That's it.
Yeah.
How do you remove it? You type it in again, same way?
I think so.
Because there's a remove button here.
Yeah. That has to be.
I like that they don't have a sign up. That's cool.
Yeah, I'm especially since we've started doing this show and I'm looking at a lot of different web applications, I detest signups because it's such a step that I don't need when I just want to check something out for 5 minutes and see if it's cool. Mm-hmm. So the more of these applications I'm seeing now that are doing this, the more happy I am because I am so tired of signing up, putting my information in. I've noticed a lot of newer applications ask for a lot less information, which is nice. They tend to just want a username, password, and email. And even I've had a couple new ones that don't require me to confirm my email, which is really nice. But still, that's a sign up. And then I'm always afraid that they're either going to sell my email address, or someday in 2 years, they're going to decide that they're going to, you know, refire up their company and start sending me emails every day. And I have to go in and remove it manually and all this kind of junk. So I like stuff without signups. And I think this is a great one.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if I like where you can use it without a signup, but then if you want added functionality, you can sign up. I like that
model. Exactly. Yeah. So this is something that people can use. Be careful, though.
Oh, here we go. How to delete the RSS feed from Pinkvine. After entering your credentials, a feed will be auto-populated in the feed URL, and just hit remove.
Oh, awesome.
So you don't really need a sign up for this.
But then, see, this is another one of those services that I go, well, how are they going to monetize? Are they going to start putting ads in my tweets? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't foresee it being around for a long time.
Do you think that's a common trend amongst some of these web apps? They're just so excited to create something useful that they don't really think about the monetization?
Or... Yeah, or maybe I always wonder sometimes, like we saw with one, I think we were talking last week, maybe it's just something in a portfolio for a development company to say, hey, this is something that, you know, when people are saying, well, what can you do? Say, well, we offer this free service called Pinkvine. Check it out. It's one of the cool things that we did.
Yeah, especially because, I mean, Twitter today, it still doesn't have monetization. But they can say, hey, we have this many million users using our software. Yeah. I mean,
but at least Twitter, I see there are clear options for monetization.
Sure.
Like this, I don't see any. So it has to be sort of just a portfolio piece or something. Mm-hmm. I'm not really sure. I mean, I'd be curious to know what they're going to do, because the one thing I don't want is I don't want ads in the tweets that they're putting out for me.
No, definitely not. They could have an ad on there where you add their thing. But yeah, that's not very good because you're only seen it once.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, there's also the possibility that maybe they'll sign up a bunch of people will use it, and then they'll say, well, we have to make you pay for it. I'm sorry. I don't know. Curious question, but we'll have to check it out later.
Okay. So what is the next app we have?
The next app we have is called Tweettree. Okay. And
a lot of it, I see common, a lot of the stuff is Twitter.
Yeah. Oh, I mean,
Twitter's getting more and more popular.
Yeah. So, and I mean, it's cool actually to see applications or even, you know, programs that are trying to sort of figure out monetization themselves come out of Twitter, which is a service that hasn't figured it out either. Mm-hmm. Anyways, what Tweettree does is it puts your Twitter stream in a tree so that you can see posts people are replying to in context. It threads your Twitter conversations for you.
It threads. Okay.
So one of my common complaints about Twitter, I used to use Jaiku a lot, is that when people reply to your posts, it's just really a generic post. You don't really know anything about it.
You don't know what you're replying to.
Yeah. So, I mean, Twitter is very flat. You just see your stream of people. So I like Jaiku because I can make a Jaiku post and people could comment on that, and it just showed up, you know, as a little reply comment to my post specifically.
But by default, doesn't only the people that are following both parties see the reply anyways, so they would see it?
Yeah, but it still doesn't.
But you don't know what you're replying to.
Yeah, exactly. So let's say a lot of times you'll see that someone will reply to someone's thing, and you're like, whoa, what post are you replying to? You know, someone who doesn't get on Twitter every single day. So they come on 2 days later, they see someone's post, and they reply to it. And you're like, whoa, what are you replying to?
Yeah, and I know Gary Vaynerchuk, the way he gets around this is he'll actually put the URL to the particular tweet that he's replying to.
Yeah.
But that takes up a lot of, you know, some characters and things. So,
And that's very manual. The whole point of this is it just puts it in a tree for you really quick, and you can just kind of go with it. So
what does it look like? Is it like a directory kind of structure tree or?
Well, let's do that. I'm signing up right now. So let me look at here. Oh, this is very clever monetization too. They actually put the ads kind of in the stream.
Okay.
Just little tiny, tiny text ads.
So kind of like the iPod. Yeah.
But what was that application?
Twitterific,
yeah. Yeah. So like right here below this, you know, Stephanie Cuialo, I can't even pronounce her name, but she's Skinny Jeans on Twitter. Right below her, there is a recipe for double chocolate candy pizza, which I do not think she would agree with eating at all because she's kind of a health person. But let me see here. Let me look at, I mean, the sad part is, okay, so here is Callie Lewis tweeted today that for the first time ever, she wanted to buy one of those Snuggie things because it's so cold. to which I replied, and I, you know, I just did the generic reply at Kelly Lewis. I said, I bought a ShamWow at Target and they work great, but I feel so ashamed telling people that I bought them. But so here I see Callie Lewis's tweet, and then just, you know, right below hers, kind of tucked in, is my reply to her.
Oh, okay.
So if
so
I
you
had,
can see what you're replying to.
Yeah, so I mean, if I had multiple people replying to certain things, it would just look like here's a tweet, and then here's the conversation below. You know, similar to a blog, post and comments.
Can I see it? See your public feed on here that's in Twitch for you, or is this just for you?
I don't think so. I think it's just for you. But since you friended me, you can log in. And here's the great thing, too. You don't have to sign up for this. You just put in your Twitter username and password, and it goes and does the API and grabs it all for you.
How does it know what you're replying to, I guess, if Twitter doesn't
you know,
keep track
of it? That's a good question. If you look
is it
at,
based on time?
Well, if you look at Twitter, when you it depends. If I just go up to the text box and I say, at Mark Sanborn, hey, what's going on? It's a generic reply. But if you look at it, I've seen this before, when you click on the actual reply thing in Twitter, it sends something else. I think it sends the post that you're replying to, because I've seen times in Twitter where it will say in reply to whatever's post, and you can actually go back to the original post you're replying to. But I think if you just do the generic at reply, it doesn't know. It just kind of has to figure it out based on time.
So maybe Twitter might integrate something like this into their service.
It's a possibility. If they're starting to track it already, then maybe. But or I could see them purchasing the development team for Tweetree or something and integrating it in there. So, oh, but here we see brought to you by Draconis Software. So it's nice. It's kind of a nice midway for people like me who... I mean, that really kind of was the big barrier to me getting into Twitter.
And their supported services down here too. It's got YouTube, Flickr, and all that stuff. Is that how does that
really?
I haven't
even played with that, to be honest with you. I just was playing around.
Whenever a link to one of these services shows up in your post you're viewing, the Tweetree will automatically pull in the content for you to view inside the post.
Oh, that's
so
nice.
Like if it's a link to YouTube, you're gonna see the video right in there without having to go to YouTube.
That totally makes sense. I guess I didn't pay enough attention, but Posh. One of the Suicide Girls named Posh, who I follow, she put up a twit pic, and it embedded the picture in the stream.
See that's nice.
Oh, I totally missed that. Yeah,
that's convenient, and that actually adds value.
That just
right
seems
there,
to
you don't have to waste your time clicking on a link and open a new tab and stuff.
Pounce used to do that, and that was why it was so special. Is it you know, Pounce's whole thing was that it integrated the media you were linking to, so like you could even post an MP3 in Pounce, and it would you know put a little flash player up for you to listen to it and stuff like that. So this is cool. I really would like to see Twitter either integrate this or like, you know, buy this technology from these people and put it in with Twitter, because it's pretty cool.
And one thing I want to notice on this one before we jump into our next topic is it has a feedback tab here.
Oh, really?
On the top right, home, about, blog, and then feedback.
Oh, okay.
So I noticed that it actually uses the app that we're going to talk about right now, actually.
Okay.
So this is an app that's already using this technology.
What app is this, Mark?
This is called, well, I don't know if they call it this, but it's feedback app. It's a feedback app by the company User Voice.
Oh, okay. So it's not, the app isn't User Voice. That's the company.
Well, I don't see like a product name.
Mm-hmm.
But what I see a lot on these sites, and you'll see it on User Voice's site, is a tab on the side that says feedback. What I just noticed here with Tweetree is that you don't have to have the tab on the side, which is nice. I find that kind of annoying.
Yeah, I've seen it on a lot of new websites, and I don't like it at all because it's just hanging out there on the side, and it looks the same on every website. So it looks really unoriginal. I thought it was really uninspired.
Yeah, where it looks like you can actually just embed your feedback URL anywhere you want.
Awesome.
It's just the one on the side is what people are using. Maybe it's a default.
Okay. So,
but User Voice, what this does is it's a way to, it's just, they do all the feedback stuff for you. You don't have to develop your own back end for your feedback. What they have, some of the features they have, voting, customers can vote on your content, your customer service, whatever, your product, your anything really. They can vote. You can kind of use it as a bug tracking thing. Like if somebody's got a complaint, you can come in and reply to it.
Wow, yeah, this is cool. I'm I'm glad to see that they actually have a feedback thing on the side of their website, the User Voice website. They actually use their own product.
Yeah, that's good too.
And so it's really cool. I click feedback, and it actually brings out a list of current ideas that they're working on, and it says, like, submit an idea. We've sent back a feedback form so you can tell us what's on your mind. Please go and be heard. And it's got, like, all the ideas that they've already heard. Like, support for multiple language has already been started. Allow negative votes or be able to vote from within the widget is a planned feature. Allow admins to set number of votes is a planned feature. Make it possible to star suggestions, planned feature.
And this is nice Very because cool. with websites, you don't know what the customer's complaints are. They just leave. They're not going to sit there. If they don't like your site, they're not going to go out of their way to tell you about it.
Yeah.
They're just going to leave.
And so hopefully this is interesting enough to get their attention and say, I think that's why a lot of websites have put the feedback thing up on the side, is because you immediately go, okay, feedback. You want some feedback? Fine. I'll give you some feedback. I mean,
especially
almost
on a beta app too, especially something that's in development right now that's not, you know, featured complete.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. So, I mean, a lot of websites, you know, every website has a contact us, but I don't want to have to fill out a thing like, no, I think your website's stupid. This is just like, okay, well, what don't you like? Take a quick survey and, you know, and the feedback thing is right there so you can get to it quick.
You can report a bug, and it makes it easy for people to say, hey, I don't like the way you do this. Mm-hmm. Fix it, please.
And so
I don't like the way your navigation's laid out or whatever it is.
So the question here is, can you do feedback on everything? So let's say you had a blog. Would the feedback pertain? Could you also do feedback for each blog post? Would it be smart enough to do that?
I believe so.
You know, so if you go to the homepage, sure. You go to jrobbins.com, you can submit feedback on the entire website, things like navigation, you know. But let's say you go to a specific blog article and then you say, well, I don't like this about this article. It'd be nice if you could just submit feedback for that one item. And it was smart enough to keep track of that. I mean, I'm sure it keeps track anyways where each item was suggested.
It looks like they have a built-in forum, too, for the customers to discuss things.
Oh, wow.
It's a threaded forum.
So I'm assuming they have a free version and a pay version, right?
Yeah, if we
go... Let's look at pricing. Okay, oh.
So the free one, you get a forum,
yep.
And you can only have 500 voters per month.
That's not bad
at all,
which
I would
think
for a startup web app would be fine.
Yeah.
To get going.
First 500 people, let me know what you think.
And not everyone's going to vote. This isn't just 500 people at your website. This is people that are going to send feedback.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably, I don't know what percentage, but you're probably fine.
Oh, a lot lower than your just viewers.
Right. and then for 19, so, and that's about all you get for the free version. For the next step up, you get the $19 a month where you get a private forum, 1,000 voters per month. You get to have analytics built in, moderation tools, which probably would be nice.
Yeah. Oh, man.
To get rid of some.
Especially if people are saying some nasty stuff about your website, it might be nice to moderate that stuff.
Well, even spam, too. I mean, I don't know how you'd function without it. domain aliasing for SEO reasons. And as soon as you start paying, you're ad-free.
Oh, man. If you get silver, though, SSL encryption.
That's nice.
And an API. You get access to the API. Ooh.
See, okay.
That's exciting. Huh, so User Voice, that's cool.
The reason I brought this one up, I haven't used it yet, but I have seen tons of websites already using it already.
Yeah, so we talked about it last week, and we kind of said that we would look into it a little bit more. And it just looks like it seems to be a full-featured feedback form, so I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a web app right now that I could try it on yet, and I don't know if it's suitable for just any website.
Yeah.
So,
I don't know. But if anyone uses it or something, let us know what you think. There's a lot of websites out there, so it kind of makes me think that they're doing good stuff. But I don't know.
Yeah, it says right here, TechCrunch is Read, Write, Web, Mashable, New York Times, PC, CNET News, Boing Boing. We just saw TweetTree is using it. Mm-hmm. Snip.net was using it, and some other web apps.
Ping.fm used it for a while. Ping.fm.
A lot of these web apps that we're already talking about. It seems like it's a popular. I mean, people are using it. So,
yeah. And I mean, my suggestion is maybe if you use it, try and make it not so obvious. Just because I hate seeing the same feedback box on the side of every web page.
Yeah.
All right. So, Mark, the next thing I want to talk about is this really cool web application I found called Clings, or Cligs. Cligs, my apologies. CLI.GS. Those weird URLs, they're all over the place.
Yeah.
What Cligs is basically it's a version of Tiny URL or Snip URL that gives you analytics. So you can see who is clicking on your stuff, and it's really good for marketing. So let's say you tweet, you know, like, oh, hey, look, Face Off Show, new episode, you know, and I, instead of using Tiny URL, which I usually do, I could use Cligs, and then I can see how many people are actually clicking on my link in Twitter.
Wow.
Yeah, because, I mean, normally I'll get, I think if you look on analytics, you'll probably get a referral from Tiny URL.
So this is kind of like Link Blip, but it actually shortens the URL as well.
Yeah, exactly. So
this isn't for just email. This is for Twitter and all those other apps.
Yeah, and
where you need a short URL.
And the cool part about this, yeah, because a lot of things require a short URL these days. And you can customize the short URL, which I don't think you couldn't do that. You couldn't do that with the Link Blips.
Oh, it was just a hash or something?
I think it just hashed. But what they say to use this for is marketing campaigns. So let's sure. say you give all your employees one Cligs, you give your corporate Twitter account one Cligs, and then you give, you know, Facebook one Cligs, Twitter one Cligs, and you can see which ones are working and which ones are going where.
This is awesome. Is it free?
Yeah, free. I'm signed up right now. I have a basic Face Off show.
How many Cligs do you get for free? Is there a pricing structure on this, or is
I'm not seeing anything right now. I think it's one of those things that they're in a.
Looks like they got an API, so if you want to whip out a bunch of URLs real fast, you can check that out too.
You could do it automatically. Yeah, exactly.
I'm looking at this, and I have to try it out still, but I don't think I'd ever use Tiny URL ever again if I had this. Unless it was something real fast and easy.
Well,
like, I want to know what they if they clicked on my stuff that I'm sending them.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Does it? I mean, how is it the analytics that says yeah they clicked, or is it actually say like what? Continent and country they're from. Yeah,
you can get a
stuff.
World map. I'm assuming what they'll probably do is probably give you more detailed analytics if you purchase later. I don't know what their monetization plan is, but so you can see, you know, just how many hits per day your Cligs got. You can see on a world map where your Cligs are coming from. You can get refer statistics. If it tells you if, you know, Yahoo, Google have seen your Cligs out there in the wild somewhere.
Real-time analytics. So it's instant. You'll know exactly when somebody clicks. So if it's not working, you can send it out again.
And what's funny is right here. Here it is again, the little feedback tab on the side.
Ooh. Now, you know, I'm a fan of SEO from our last podcast and some of the articles I've written. I see here that Cligs uses 301 to forward, as opposed to some other sites use JavaScript and something to forward on. So you get the SEO benefits for this URL.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So this URL means this is the actual content, this 301. This one's the one to use.
Okay.
Don't index this Cligs into the search engine. Use mine.
It's not just saying like, hey, welcome to this website. Now you need to move over here. It's saying, right. No, this is not the real website. You need to look over there.
This is the real one. Put this one in your search results. Not
okay.
mine, which is awesome.
Very cool. That's great for SEO.
I don't know if the other ones do that, but they advertise this right here. And I like that feature.
Very cool.
Because there's different ways to redirects. There's PHP, JavaScript, blah blah blah. Mm-hmm. 301's the one to use if you want search engine.
Yeah, it sounds like the good one for search engines. I hate JavaScript redirects and stuff like that. They're all over the place. So check out Cligs. I think it's really cool. It's a good idea. Especially, you know, you log into your Cligs account. And you know, you can look at all your Cligs that you have made and kind of see which ones are having an impact and almost think of sort of guerrilla marketing campaigns to see where your social media is helping you out.
This is awesome.
So check it out, cli.gs.
And I noticed they have the feedback tab on the left. So they're using the user voice.
Yeah, I said that like.
Oh, you did?
30 seconds ago.
I missed it. All right, so what do we got next?
Oh, man. Okay, so that's it for our web apps today. That's a lot of web apps. I'm kind of exhausted. So the first topic that we kind of want to talk about is a little article that Mark found called How to Monetize Your Web App. So, Mark, why don't you give us a brief overview of that and what we can expect?
Okay. Well, when I first started blogging and doing all that stuff, I was like, oh, money, money, money. I want to eat the money. I want to do this. I'm doing it all. Well, I didn't do it all for the money. I liked the articles. I liked doing the publishing. It was fun. But
I mean, you wanted supplemental income. That's, I mean,
yeah,
we like to help everybody, but if you're going to help, you might as well try and get a little something back for your work, right?
Yeah. And so this is a list of basically all the different well, some of the ways you can use to monetize whatever you're doing. Probably the easiest one would be the advertising model. It doesn't matter what you're talking about or how small you are. You can get AdSense as long as you're not a spammer. You can get on AdSense and you can start making money.
Yeah, I mean, I could put AdSense on my resume online and maybe get a couple clicks. You know,
you're going
to
get clicks.
It's really easy to set up. It's really easy to insert. The downside is it's not as full rich. You're not getting as much money.
You're not going to get rich off of it. Yeah. Unless you've got literally millions of users.
Yeah.
Or hundreds of thousands.
Yeah. And it's really the sort of shotgun of monetization. You know, you're just like, all right, well, if you're going to come here, you're going to see some ads and click on a couple and give me, you know, $2 a month.
Yeah. Okay. So the first one they say is subscription-based model. The next one's advertising model. This is the easiest one. Just throw an AdSense or text link ad, or there's tons. You can sell stuff online. They mention here Cafe Press for, you know, you can design a t-shirt, send it up, and I don't know. There's a lot of people making money doing
buys
that
it, then, yeah. If someone buys it, then you get a little cut of the money on it, right?
Another example of this one that's popular right now is iPhone apps. People developing those and making a buck off each one they sell.
Yeah.
Thousands of people have them. So they've got a revenue sharing model. This is like the AdSense where Google gets some of the money and you get some, or like referral links, like the DreamHost.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So I was wrong talking about advertising at first. Their advertising model is what I think is important. Where you go out, you cold call people, and you sell advertising space.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So private ads.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Private ads. I was thinking this revenue sharing ad model, which is definitely the shotgun on the bunch. Yeah. But we'll talk about.
Sort of like Google gets a piece of it, and you get a small portion of that piece.
Yeah.
So, and there's a bunch of those. There's MSN's got one. Yahoo's got their own network of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got the pay-per-click. So this is also similar. Pay-per-click. So there's commission-based ones where you get a chunk if somebody buys, like Amazon's one of these.
Yep.
If you send somebody to Amazon through a link and then they buy something, you get a percentage.
Yeah, I do that with Montana Fragfest. I have a little thing up the corner that displays gaming items. And if someone clicks on one of those and buys them, I get a cut. I share the revenue that Amazon would get.
Mm-hmm. And DreamHost is that way too. You get a commission of everybody you refer.
Yeah.
Versus AdSense, where you just get a fraction of the cut, you know. Mm-hmm. So, another one I see here is sell your web app. If you do have a web app that goes big, Google and some other companies have been known to, you know, catch or swap them up.
Yeah, that model is becoming less popular now as money tightens up. There was kind of that boom for a while where, I mean, that was a viable. And it kind of, I thought it was really weird, but that was a viable monetization sort of idea, was that we're going to build something that will get bought out and then we'll be done.
Yeah, because they were building all kinds of stuff and thinking that Google's, because Google was buying tons of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, everything.
Like everything.
So I don't like that model as much. I mean, if an offer comes along to purchase your application and you want to seriously consider it, I think that's a great thing, but that should not be your plan from the beginning. I don't like that at all.
Okay, so let's talk about these a little bit. So I have some experience in the sell stuff online, as I work for somebody that sells things online.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, when they think sell stuff online, they say, oh, how do I take credit cards? How do I do all that stuff?
Yeah.
And
that was the big hump I found back, a while ago.
Yeah, back in the day, it was really hard to do that.
You had to purchase sort of a processing account, and there was like XML that you're sending via curl. Mm-hmm. It was really grotesque and not fun.
Okay, so right now you can't. Okay, so you can totally build your entire shopping cart e-commerce system if you want, and you can use something like Authorize.net to actually take the credit card and go from there and get the money, mm-hmm. but you still control the cart. Then there's also Google has a program called Google Checkout,
mm-hmm.
which it is the entire cart. Well, it's an API for a cart.
Yeah.
So you can just send the items to Google, and then the person checks out through Google, and Google takes a percentage mm-hmm. of the
PayPal has done for a while.
And yeah, I was going to mention too, PayPal has the merchant account too. They have the same thing.
I thought PayPal's was a little bit more clunky though. It didn't seem as full featured as the Google one.
Okay, but the reason I wanted to, I agree with that. checkout is a little bit easier. One of the things I wanted to mention here is if you, it's not very hard. It's not that hard.
Yeah, it's
the
not
the Google checkout one especially has, if you, you can just copy and paste a little HTML button and you're done.
Yeah.
If you don't want to,
awesome.
There's levels of integration. If you want full control where you want to send out email, you know, you want a full control, you can do their, they call it like tier two integration.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to need to know how to do some programming. But like if you're just, you know, a lady wanting to sell stuff out of the house or whatever, the Google checkout's super easy. You can copy and paste and you're ready to go. You're selling stuff online.
Let's say I install WordPress on a domain and I make pages for, you know, in WordPress for all my things I want to sell. I can use Google checkout and not even have to touch it one bit. I just create the link, put it that in my post,
yep.
And boom.
And Google checkout also has, and I believe PayPal does too, is a digital download buying too. So like if you're selling a PDF ebook or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you just put it in there. As soon as they're confirmed that the payment has gone through, Google sends them a download link for them to get it.
Awesome. That's really cool.
So why I wanted to say this is, I mean, if anybody can go out and start selling stuff, it's not that yeah, hard anymore.
The funny part is now the hardest infrastructure is the local infrastructure of packing the item up and shipping it. Whereas it used to be the whole jumble was kind of hard and difficult, mm-hmm. You know, but.
And that's another thing. The Google checkout will actually calculate shipping and stuff for you using UPS, Priority Mail, and FedEx APIs.
Wow.
And if you don't trust them, you can make it your own too. But that's getting into the second tier integration.
Yeah.
But
that's cool that it hits all levels. You can get the lady with the WordPress blog that just wants to sell stuff and get some money. Or you can get the Mark Sanborns that are going to do full, you know, brew your own shopping cart systems and all that jazz.
And one of the advantages I would say to getting checkout over PayPal is you're going to be indexed in Google's index Frugal and stuff over PayPal.
Yeah.
And you're going to have the little logo that says checkout with Google.
Mm-hmm. We haven't heard. And also I would be really nervous about PayPal because, I mean, Google checkout hasn't been around long enough, I don't think, for this to happen. But PayPal has done some shady stuff in the past with closing people's accounts without proper notification, you know, removing their account kind of and just saying because you're in violation of their terms without any prior warning or anything like that. And just the truth is I trust Google more than I trust PayPal.
Google's about the trusting and the blocking out and stuff. The way checkout gets rid of spammers and things is they have a review system. They will send an email to the customer and ask how the store went, like about 30 days or so after the transaction. And just like kind of like the eBay model, if somebody's saying this store sucks, they never sent me their stuff, the shipping took forever, blah, 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 Google will just shut you off.
Awesome.
So that's good.
Yeah, that's because
because they're trying to say, hey, if you check out through Google, you are going to get your thing. This is safer than just buying from a little old lady out of her house.
Who says,
even though it
give me a phone call with your credit card information,
exactly.
And I'll process
it's more
it
secure,
hand.
And then also it weeds out the spammers by just, if they're not, you know, just same like eBay, if they're not providing, they just kick them off.
Good.
So you're pretty secure by buying it. So that gives customers a better view of your stuff that you're selling.
That's cool.
It's not very hard anymore. So the advertising model used to be the easiest one. This is just still pretty easy.
Yeah. I want to talk about the advertising model because I've focused on this a little bit. One of the things I think is going to happen sort of with the web is that advertising is going to shift locally. We all have Google AdSense, and for what little revenue you can get with Google, it takes up a lot of space. So I think these companies are paying Google big money to show up on certain keywords and you're getting your small chunk. I think the future is going to be local advertising or face-to-face cold calling, company-to-company advertising, not revenue sharing advertising. One of the things I'm working on is a website I called Bozeman Review, and sort of my monetization plan is to sell advertisements to local businesses. And I think this is a great model because for a lot less space, I can get a local ad, and for them, it's not much money. I can say, you know, 10 bucks a month, I put you on this little square or in this rotation of ads. I mean, I can design my own system, and to them, it's only 10 bucks a month, but for me, that's way more money than I ever would have got from Google for that amount of space, unless I have, you know, more visitors than I ever need. Mm-hmm. So I think the basic advertising model is going to really start moving forward as people decide. I mean, you can even do this on the internet. Call up corporations that have similar things that you've noticed have been putting ads out and say, hey, why don't we cut out the middleman? Let's cut out this AdSense middleman and just let me, you know, I'll put you a small advertising blip on my site. Here's my traffic. I mean, why don't we? Let's send it out to a couple people. And if you get one or two, that's more guaranteed money per month than you will get guaranteed through Google. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've seen this with Google. There's some months, Mark, where you have some major traffic and get some good money, and then there's other months where it doesn't. But if it's a local business and if you have that face-to-face interaction and say, hey, you know, I'm working with you on this, there's a higher chance that they'll stay with you month after month. And to them, it's just a small bit of money, but good advertising for them, and that's good advertising revenue for you.
Yeah, private is way better for that. I know Google has contacted us, and they said it's about 2%.
Yeah,
people actually click through and then end up buying.
Yeah.
So if you can do the local, it's better. And especially with the Bozeman Review, you're all local. That's all local.
Yeah, I mean, it's designed to be a place for local people. Yeah.
AdSense probably doesn't have a place on that kind of site.
No, it could, but at the same time, if someone goes to Bozeman Review, my local business is probably not going to have an ad thing through Google to show up on ads that say Bozeman restaurants, because that's too expensive.
One of the things that AdSense doesn't provide you is the impressions.
Yeah.
You don't get paid for impressions.
Yeah, exactly. So, but for, you know, something like a local restaurant, impressions are a big thing. Whether or not they click through is not important.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, if someone's saying, hey, I want to figure out a restaurant in Bozeman, Montana, here's a website, Bozeman Review, and then they go on and there's a little ad on the side with like a picture of a nice steak or something like that. That can sell people to your restaurant. The downside is it's hard to show results for things like that.
You can show views and impressions, and you can show clicks.
I can show views, but it doesn't, you know, I don't have a record of that person looking at that ad and saying, oh man, let's go to that restaurant.
Exactly.
It's tough, but I mean, if you're a solid entrepreneur and can let people know about these benefits in a good way that they understand, then I think you're okay. Mm-hmm. But I think that model is going to increase a lot more, and the sort of AdSense revenue sharing model is going to cut down a little bit.
And I noticed all the big blogs, they all do private advertising on the top above the fold.
Yeah, exactly.
They do the above the fold 128 by 128 boxes image ads.
Exactly. And then if you don't have any of those, then, you know, put AdSense there, or put, you know, a refer link for Dreamhost or something on there.
And yeah, like Amazon or anybody that just automatically would, you know, they're already set up.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's really cool. I'm trying to think. I guess that's really all I had to say. That's kind of my big soapbox for this.
I guess the takeaway on this is it's pretty easy, actually. If you're interested in setting up some kind of monetization on something, selling stuff and advertising, especially the selling stuff, has gotten way easier than it used to be. And advertising is the same way. You can set up AdSense in 5 minutes and
exactly.
Be ready to go.
And if you start pumping out good content, you can get views and clicks.
Yeah.
So. All right, so Mark, the next topic we kind of want to talk about, this is a bag of worms or a bag of snakes or whatever. I don't know what the saying is. Version control. So what is version control in general, and why do I want to use it, Mark?
Version control helps you keep control of the versions of the different software. And you can go back to something you've previously written about, so it's, I don't want to say it's a backup solution, because it's not really.
No, it's more of a development workflow solution.
Right. You can see a history of how things flow mm-hmm. through the development process. I use it as a like a sandbox solution. I've got a server where I work and play with in the sandbox.
Yeah,
that's where the term comes
clever,
from.
Yep.
As soon as I feel it's okay, it's good, it's been tested enough, I commit that code to the repository, and then I go to my production server and say update to the newest code.
Okay. So you and I primarily use Subversion.
Yes.
Which is a pretty popular one now. I think it was made to be sort of a replacement for CVS?
That one was CMS for us.
CVS. Okay.
CVS.
CVS.
Or maybe CSV. No, that's the Excel.
That's comma separated value.
CVS. It's CVS.
CVS. So here's your basic Subversion workflow. I create a repository. Right now it's empty. There's nothing in it.
What's a repository, just to be clear on that? Just like a
repository is where all the work gets done. Where it's you know, a repository for your code. It's hard to explain. It's the bucket where your code is.
Okay.
And in that bucket, there's all kinds of sorting and smart things that happen. So I check out or I create an empty repository. So then I go on my development computer and I say, okay, check this out. And so it goes out to the repository and it says, what's the latest version? And it pulls it down to my local box. So I go and then I develop. I make all my changes to my code, and what I do then is I commit them. So it looks, it's smart. It looks at what I've written and it sees what is different, and then it uploads my changes to the repository as a new version.
So this is good for programmers that are collaborating, working together, so they don't accidentally write over somebody else's work.
I would say these sort of systems are essential if you have more than one programmer. It would be silly to try and do it manually.
So I know you've, in your environment, this is usually what you use. You use something for programmers to collaborate, and so you don't accidentally write over code. And where in mine, I use it as here's one server, I'm working on it, and as soon as I see it's good, then I publish it.
Yeah, so let's say there's two, you and I are working on this project, right? And you and I both check out the current version right now. It's version one, all right? We did version one, we check out version one, and I'm working on a different feature than you are. And I'm working, and you're working. And so the benefit of this is that when I'm working and I get done with my little feature that I was working on, whatever, I can commit that to the repository, and it says, okay, oh, so this version hasn't changed since you brought it down, so that's okay. So it pushes it up to the server, and then you go to your code and you say, update, and it goes, it talks to the repository and says, oh, there's some new stuff. So it pulls it down, but it looks at what you've already done. Mm-hmm. And so it makes sure that, you know, if you and I wrote code kind of in the same place, that's a conflict, and it lets you know that. It doesn't override it, but it kind of keeps it there and says, hey, you need to resolve this conflict. And then you get all my other changes that I'm done and everything like that. So then you can go through, and then when you're done coding with your stuff, you commit it and I can pull it down. And it creates this good workflow that doesn't really erase things. I mean, it involves a little bit sometimes some manual conflict resolution, both.
But you're never going to lose work.
No. Yeah, that's the cool thing is every time you commit, it's a different version. You can go back and look at different versions. You can compare different versions. Like at work, we had this instance where I was working on something and I committed it, and my buddy thought something was wrong, and so he committed a change that just got rid of all my changes. And I said, whoa, what happened? And he's like, oh, did I do that? I'm sorry. And I said, that's okay. And I just went back to the repository and I said, you know, give me that version that I committed, and I grabbed it back down, so my work that I had before was there, and I just recommitted it, and I said, don't erase it this time.
So you can use it to revert to prior versions. So
yeah.
So if you do screw something up, you can always go back.
Yeah. So at one point I made an error, and we had committed several versions after I made that error, but we didn't find out about the error until later. Mm. I was able in my code to just kind of say revert to the previous version and then test it. Like, okay, that's still broken. Revert to the previous version. Okay, that's still broken. We went revert to the previous version, and it worked. And I said, oh, okay, so what in that commit did I change? And I can do a diff between those two different versions to see what I actually changed between those two versions and find where I screwed up.
Okay, cool.
It was really handy that day. I mean, that would have been days of digging through code.
So there's tons of ways you can use SVN or version control, actually. I want to say version control.
Yeah, exactly.
SVN is just one.
That's, yeah, I mean, we use app. SVN, but there's a lot of other good ones out there that people really like.
So you can use it as like coding for you, collaborating with other programmers. You can use it as kind of like this is the development version, this is the production version. Mm-hmm. Other things I've seen people do with it is like to-do lists. You can see
yep.
a history of what you do.
Yeah,
that's, you know, kind of thing, because you can see backward anything that you want to see, the history or version.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just limited to programming, although that's usually what it's used with.
It works best with just text, with just, you know,
yeah,
rich text files.
It's not
going to
work with a binary. Well, it does do binaries, but it's not going to version control binaries.
It can't look at, yeah, it can't look at the difference between them. All it knows is there's a size difference. But yeah, so any like a to-do file in an RTF file is perfect for it.
So like diaries or like logs or something. Another good one. Systems, corporate procedures and things like that. If they were written in LaTeX,
yeah,
you could do easily do version control with that. So there's a bunch of different things.
Yeah, and so the two big ones that we kind of wanted to talk about were Git and SVN, which is Subversion and Git. I guess disclaimer, because I don't want to offend anybody. Mark and I primarily use Subversion, and we're both thinking about trying Git. I'm going to try Git, but we haven't a whole lot of experience on it. But I've talked to a lot of people about it, so I think
we can talk about it, but we don't. We're not experts on it.
Yeah. So I mean, really, if anybody has any, you know, good Git websites or something that we should look at, let us know. You know, comment back to us and let us know, because we really want to learn more about this and are kind of exploring it with you guys here on the air, because we're pretty new to it. So, as I understand it, Git is a really flexible version control system, versus Subversion is pretty strict.
Okay.
You have the sort of way Subversion is supposed to work is you have your development, which is called the trunk, your development trunk, which is always bleeding edge, the new stuff everybody's working on, you know, may or may not work. It's not even alpha. It's just what developers are working on. It could be broken. And then you branch off. How you want to do the workflow differs, but Subversion has these big branches. A branch is a big thing that you do and you work, and then you merge those branches again into a release.
Is a branch the same as a fork?
And kind of.
Like how Boxy forked off of XBMC. Like they said, I like your code, but I want to make something kind of different.
That's kind of. A fork tends to be more of an official separation. A branch, like, so how I would use it personally if I was releasing software is that my trunk would always be bleeding edge, brand new stuff. But let's say I release version one, right? We release version one. Hooray, happy day. I would create a version one branch so that I can keep working on version two, which has all these really cool features and stuff. But let's say something happens in version one.
A major version.
Yeah, this is how I, again, this is not, okay. I mean, I've talked to the people and they view it separately, but I would do a version one branch and then my version two bleeding, you know, trunk, my development. And then let's say something happens. Let's say we find a vulnerability in version one, right? Oh, no. Well, I don't want to release all these changes that I'm working on for 2.0 because they're not ready and they're not released yet. So I can go to that branch, make all my changes and my fixes. No big deal. And then when I am ready to release version 2, I merge the two together. So the fixes that I had in my branch will be included in my version 2.0. Hmm. But I can still keep track of that version 1.0 by itself.
I see. So it's like a minor version. You're fixing bugs. You're fixing minor requests, minor features.
Yeah.
Maybe not even new. Not really new features. And then this one's all like, these are the new features. So this is like WordPress 2.8 instead of, you know, 2.7 bug fixes.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, 2.71 would come out. That's part of that branch, that 2.7 branch, while you're working on the 2.8 trunk. And then when you do release 2.8, you create another 2.8 branch so that you can work on your 2.9 trunk.
Okay. And does Git do this similarly?
Git does, but the difference between Git and SVN is SVN, Subversion. I say SVN because every command for Subversion is SVN, but it is Subversion. Subversion is a central repository where everyone connects and they check out from the central repository and update to the central repository. Git is specifically decentralized. Subversion, I've kind of come to the conclusion that I think Subversion is very release friendly and Git is very developer friendly.
Okay.
So that merge that we talked about in Subversion is an expensive process in both time and code. It's not, you don't do it every day. You just don't want to. Git is designed to be very decentralized and very flexible that you are branching all the time.
Okay.
So a good example my coworker had was that he would, you know, pull from the main developer Git repository. And then he would just branch just for the stuff that he was working on. So not to pollute the main development line, because he's like, well, what if I'm working on something that's totally experimental that might break it? He's like, I don't want to commit that to that version all the time. But in Subversion, you can't branch so easily because merging is an expensive process. Git is really smart about that. It says you can branch and merge really easily. It's really fun and exciting. So do it as much as you want.
Okay. I see here too, you can work offline, where Subversion, if you want to commit, you have to be online, where this, you have your own with Git. You're kind of you have your own repository before you actually commit it.
It's very decentralized. So you have your own Git repository when you check it. You don't check it out, but you pull from it. And then what you can do then with Git is you can push to other repositories. So you might have a central Git repository somewhere that the company set up, and you can push to that if you want, or you can pull from that, or you can pull from another developer's Git repository. So if you say, like, Bill's like, oh, you got to check out this feature I'm working on, then you say, all right, well, I'm working on this. Let's pull from Bill's and let's see what he's got. And Bill can say, you know, no, I don't want you to push to mine because you're going to screw it up. But, you know, it's decentralized and very focused on kind of the developer working on their own copy.
Okay. I also noticed here, I'm looking at an article. It's comparing the different commands, and it looks like the checkouts and things is a lot easier.
Yeah.
The shorter commands and it looks like a lot easier to use. Yeah, once you figured it out.
Yeah, it's like sort of Subversion is the rock. You know, it's been there. It can do things what you want. Kind of clunky, but it's easy to start with, and it's very focused in what it does. Git is really ad hoc. It's kind of like, you know, it's got a drink and walking around the party saying, like, hey, what's going on? I'm, you know, you're your own person. Whereas, you know, Subversion says, I am the repository, and you will get updates from me, and you will commit changes to me, and that is it. And Git is really flexible. It's looking all over the place to other people's stuff.
I know it's gaining a lot of steam, and it's getting more popular, so it's something I'm going to definitely check into.
Yeah, I mean, we really should, because I know a lot of guys where I work use it and love it, because it's just so flexible for developers. And, I mean, that's really nice, because it makes sense to have maybe a Subversion repository for releases, so that, you know, this is great. Like WordPress, you and I check out WordPress via their Subversion repository, so that when they release a new version, I can just do SVN update and it will update from the newest version from their repository. I'm not doing development with it. I'm not changing it a whole lot, maybe minor little things. So it's a good release repository.
Although if you did make a change, you'd be able to merge it.
You could.
But you don't want to be changing. You want to make a plugin. If you're changing WordPress core stuff, you want to make a plugin instead. But yeah, there's different uses. Like, that's another use that I was going to mention, is you can actually download code for, you know, a lot of web hosts have these one click install things, where sometimes if they've got SSH access, all you have to do is do like SVN checkout, and you can check out like WordPress or whatever, and it's automatically uploaded.
And SVN is so popular; it's out there a lot.
Right.
So I mean, if you can learn SVN, it's really helpful to you. I would say that if you're a power developer, though, you really need to look at Git. Now, the problem, though, is a lot of these systems already have Subversion on and working, and therefore, you know, the thought of putting in something new, like Git and SVN don't talk together very well. They don't really like each other. There's some plugins out there and stuff that you can do to try and, you know, commit to a Git repository to a Subversion repository using Git locally and stuff, but it gets really hairy. So that is one of the other hurdles that you're going to have to get over, is these systems where everyone is used to using Subversion already. I know I was really kind of hesitant about it when my coworkers were like, well, you got to check out Git. I was like, no, I finally would say that I'm kind of a Subversion power user, so I'm not going to learn that. All right, this crazy Git stuff, I don't need that. But once I looked at it, it really, for a power developer, if you're doing especially stuff with a lot of other people, you really should be using Git.
I also wanted to mention that the original code, the original development and idea for Git was created by Linus Torvalds, which was the original founder of the Linux kernel.
Yeah.
So
he knows a thing or two about programming, I would say.
He's done a few merge and diffs and edits in his day. So
yeah, exactly.
He looked at Subversion and he said, "Hey, I think we need a few more features."
Yeah,
and that's pretty much how Git was born.
And it's great, because it's saying, "Hey, I'm a developer. I need something that's designed for me." And why not? If it is better for developers, shouldn't you be using it?
And this is great. I mean, it's CVS, right? The original one, and everybody liked that. It was like, oh, this is great. And then Subversion came out, and it was like, oh, this is better. And
yeah. Well, hopefully when Git Subversion came out, everybody was like, well, why would I learn Subversion? I know CVS already. Mm-hmm. So, I mean,
And that wasn't even that long ago.
No. So, I mean, I have a feeling that Git's going to be kind of the new kid on the block that might become the big thing that people use in the future. Mm-hmm. So you might as well start learning it now.
Yep.
And I know I'm way behind the curve on that. There's a lot of people out there that know Git, and we're probably going to get some scoffs from this, you know, podcast, being like, what do you mean? I've been using Git forever, and you're in it. Well, I apologize. I'm behind the times.
I have not even used it once. All I know is I've heard a lot about it, though.
Yeah. So we got to get on the ball, Mark.
All right. So what else do we have here?
You know, actually, that about wraps it up for that this show, Face Off. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe via faceoffshow.com/feed. But I also want to really remind you that if you have any suggestions or comments, please email us studio@faceoffshow.com, reply to us on Twitter, or comment on this episode on our blog. We're always looking for comments or suggestions. Mark and I are always trying to improve everything that we do. So any thoughts or comments are always welcome, and we really, really like them. So,
and if you've got something, anything on Git or any of the other topics that you'd want to share via audio, we'll also take that and probably play that on the air.
Yeah, that would be awesome if anybody wanted to record audio and attach it to an email you send to, you know, or send us a YouTube link or anything. We'd love it. So thank you, and we'll see you guys next week.